Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Well, welcome along to Unbelievable, the show that gets Christians and non-Christians talking every Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio in the UK. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for the next hour and a half. And whether you're listening via our Freeview service, DAB across the country, or on Medium Wave in London and the South East, it's great to have you with me. And perhaps you're listening via the internet at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. That's where you can find our podcast, and I'll be giving out that address again later on in the day. Don't forget, near the end of today's programme, we'll hear some of your feedback to last week's programme with atheist Philip Pullman. Fascinating conversation we had with him then. But today we're looking at another author and another book. Let me tell you what's coming up today. You're unbelievable. Well, welcome along to the show that gets Christians and non-Christians talking. And today, a really interesting special show for you. We're looking at the book The Rage Against God. It's been written by Peter Hitchens, brother of very famous atheist Christopher Hitchens. But Peter himself is a columnist for The Mail on Sunday. And his book seeks to show that we need a response, I suppose, to the modern surge of anti-theism. That's what it's seeking to do, to respond to it. Ask whether society can really live independently of God and faith. In a conversation today with Peter, Adam Rutherford. Adam is an editor at the science journal Nature, a contributor to The Guardian, and he's an atheist himself. So I think we're going to have a fascinating time on the show this afternoon. Hope you can stay with me right through till 4 o'clock. And don't forget, you can find the podcast online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Because we live in a technological age, but it could be said, Peter, that you, as it were, your book is nostalgic of an age we once lived in, perhaps.
No, not at all. I'm not a nostalgist. I'm always being accused of it. I have no nostalgia at all. I remember the 1950s very well, and all the things about them that were unpleasant, grubby, squalid, and best left behind. And it's a futile indulgence, as I say in the book. UK, it's a thing that people, when they reach a certain age, want to do. They want to open a door into the past so their parents, who are dead, could still be alive. But it really isn't of any purpose if you want to have any say in how society should be. What I'm concerned about is the future and the way in which we have been busily choosing the wrong future for much of the past 50 years. So no, it's not nostalgic at all. It's simply nothing to do with trying to bring the past back to life, but it is something to do with looking at the past and drawing lessons from it about how we should behave now.
You're pretty open about the fact this is in many ways a response to your brother, who you term not just an atheist but an anti-theist. He in some ways has been at the front of the charge against God and belief in God.
Well, that's his term, not mine. So yes, of course it's a response to him. In fact, I was approached initially by an American publisher and asked to write it as a response to him, and for some time I said no, and eventually they persuaded me to say yes. So yes, there's no point pretending it's anything other than a response to him. His designation of anti-theist is quite an interesting combination. An American friend of mine says the position of these people is, there is no God and I hate him. And this does seem to sum up an awful lot of what comes out of the anti-theist press at the moment.
It sort of starts off with, and ends in a way, with you reflecting on a debate you had with your brother a couple of years ago in Grand Rapids in Michigan. And I've seen that online and watched you both.
Oh, it's terrible. Absolutely awful. I don't recommend it to anybody unless you really, really are having a sleep problem. It was a disaster from every conceivable
but
point
presumably
of view. One of the reasons for writing the book was to try and, as it were, hold the match, which was effectively rained off by the strange conditions which actually obtained at that debate.
Yes, I mean, you reflect on the book in the book how perhaps the organisers were hoping for some kind of sibling rivalry, fisticuffs kind of encounter.
And it's always possible, isn't it?
but it's fair. You admit as well that you haven't always seen eye to eye with Christopher. Hardly ever.
Hardly ever, I think I could say without telling any untruths. Since early childhood, we fought.
And you've taken radically different lines, obviously, in terms of your beliefs and your faith. Perhaps you could take us back a little to your early life, though, as you do in the book. You started out, really, as a teenager, really abandoning faith and being very militantly anti-faith in some ways.
Well, I think I probably abandoned faith before I was a teenager. I think it's recorded at my prep school headmaster asking me. He'd obviously spotted there was something going on. He was used to people like me asking me, and my saying, I suppose, around about the age of 12, that I didn't believe. I think a lot of people around about that age, when they begin to develop as independent human beings, start to doubt the existence of God. In fact, they start to doubt practically everything they've been told. It's a normal adolescent process, and it continued right through my adolescence, which lasted, I suppose, until I was about 30, with the same supposedly enlightened, supposedly bold and challenging, supposedly original beliefs, which so many people imagine atheism amounts to.
And you sort of held that in common with a sort of quite radical socialism as well, and you...
Radical socialism is putting it a bit mildly. I was a revolutionary socialist and a Trotskyist.
You describe in the course of the book how your life experiences and the fact that the socialist, the radical, revolutionary socialist dream came crashing down, and you sort of...
Well, it was all rubbish. It was patently rubbish and dangerous, bloodthirsty rubbish at that. And once you realise that, then you either have to withdraw, as it went, to private life and cultivate your garden, or you have to engage in some other form of activity. And actually, if you've ever had a worldview of any power or width, then if the one that you have collapses, it certainly was important to me to construct another one. It took quite a long time to do.
You describe your journey then back to faith, and there's a particularly interesting sort of point in that journey where you describe coming face to face with a depiction of the Last Judgment while on holiday, and you weren't expecting it to, but this had quite a profound effect upon
you. No, and I tell the story because it's disadvantageous to me. And what it says is that I was motivated to some extent by fear. I think people often try and pretend that they're not. And that I thought it was idle for me on this occasion to say that it wasn't so. When I saw this picture, I was completely astonished by the force of it and had not in any way expected it. I look at a lot of pictures. I was wandering, as I used to do a lot in those days, around France by train and bicycle, looking at every single piece of artistic and architectural wonder that was available there. And it was after lunch in Beaune, in the middle of Burgundy, and we looked at the guidebook, and there it was, Roger van der Weyden's Last Judgment, 3 stars, worth the journey, not just worth the detour. And I thought, oh, not another religious painting, because in that stage of my life I rather resented the fact that so much art was religious. Walked in, looked at it, and there at the bottom were all these figures. And look at it yourself. It's a terrific painting if you like the Flemish masters, which I do in any case. But look at it, and you'll see that the people stumbling around naked as the last trump wakens them from the tomb look almost exactly the way people looked in the late 1970s and 1980s. They haven't got any clothes on, but they've got the same sort of hair and the same sort of faces. And I recognized myself and people I knew among them. And suddenly, as I say, normally you look at these paintings and they're coated with thick layers of time. Mm. This occasion, they weren't there. It was an event actually taking place. And it fixed in my mind the idea, which had been planted there a long, long time ago, that it was possible that I might be judged. And looking rapidly at my past at that time, I thought that I'd probably come off pretty badly.
Well, it's a fascinating sort of little picture of what happened, one of the stages along the journey that brought you back to faith. We'll talk more about that in the course of the programme, but let me introduce our other guest, Adam Rutherford, now. Adam, thank you for coming in.
My pleasure.
First time on this programme today. You're an editor at the science journal Nature. You're a scientist by background, I take it.
That's right, a PhD in genetics.
And your atheism, is that linked, would you say, particularly to your scientific background?
No, not specifically. I think it is connected in the sense that both are based on a rational position. But unlike Peter, there was never ever a question in my life that the existence of God was a possibility, and so there was no conversion even at the age of 12 when I, as Peter said, began to become an independent human being. There was never a moment when I decided actually this didn't make a lot of sense. It was just never really a possibility that it could make sense. And so in terms of being an atheist, it's a term that I'm not that fond of. Just as I'm not that fond of the Christopher Hitchens' term, anti-theist, I just take the position that I see no reason or evidence that would support a belief in the supernatural.
I have to confess, I came across you in the summer last year when you did a piece for The Guardian, and it was your experience of attending an Alpha course. Quite a number of people commenting on that in the Comment is Free blog on The Guardian. You've obviously, therefore, looked into things, you know, in the Christian faith, but you've never found it particularly satisfying in terms of questions answered or...
No, I'm interested in it from a sociological point of view. I'm not particularly interested in some of the more tedious arguments of whether God actually exists. What I think is fascinating about Christianity and all religion is that people believe in God, and that, I think, is enough to warrant investigating in a calm and rational way. The reason I did the Alpha course was to look at this. It was a major phenomenon. It is a major phenomenon. It's one of the biggest growth areas in Christianity across the world. And it occurred to me that most people who are vocal within, if you want to call it, the atheist movement, actually really don't spend a lot of time either in church or talking to people of faith. And I thought this was an easy way to investigate a phenomenon and deal with that, which I consider to be problematic.
It would be fascinating to get you in again, maybe to have a chat with one of the, you know, originators of the course at some point. But we'll leave that for another show, perhaps. For today, the Rage Against God, what do you make of, well, firstly, perhaps, what do you make of Christopher Hitchens, you know, who obviously him and the new atheists that the book is aimed as a response to?
Well, I think that Christopher is largely right in terms of his belief that God doesn't exist. He's a polemicist, much like, I think, it's fair to say, his brother sitting next to me is. I think his arguments are forthright and bold, and he's extremely eloquent and persuasive. I don't necessarily think that the tone that anti-theists, if you wish to call them that, take is particularly constructive or useful. But in terms of propagating revolutions, I think it's important that people like him and Richard Dawkins have opened the door such that this is a conversation that is live, such that people who are moderates, who are more accepting of the existence of faith, or secularists, which I think is much more important than atheism, can have open and free-ranging discussions about this, because secularism, to my mind, is much more important in terms of the future of society than whether the rather mundane question of whether God actually exists or not.
So you're in favour in that sense of a sort of evangelistic form of atheism that seeks to show people why belief in God is unnecessary and unhelpful.
My position is more a sort of wishy-washy liberal position, which is that I believe that the answers to universal questions that science and rationality offer are better answers than the ones that the church or faith offers. And therefore, my position would always be put all the information out on the table, educate people to the extent that they're capable of making an informed decision for themselves, and letting them do that.
And lastly, what do you make of Peter's that moment when he stood in front of that picture of the Last Judgment? I suppose that is something that ultimately is a very subjective experience. You can't scientifically test what happened in Peter's response to that picture.
No, of course not. And I think that's it's fascinating that it happened. I haven't had that sort of conversion yet. Or
can I just intervene here? It's not a conversion. It's a moment in a journey. It's not. I had no blazing flash or sudden moment. It's an important moment, and I describe it. But it's not it's not a conversion experience, and I wouldn't want it to be described by anybody as such. I don't actually believe in that kind of language, and I sympathise with you having undergone the Alpha course. It would have driven me away from Christianity as fast as all get out.
No, okay, I accept that it's possibly not a conversion moment, but the way you described it, it's still a pretty radical reaction from someone who's been in a position for a period of time, and this was a key moment in taking a fairly radically opposed position.
There was a moment when I started to worry quite seriously, actually. That's the point. It has changed my behaviour, too.
And you say, Peter, that, it was not an immediate sort of... You were then attending church every Sunday or anything. There was a gradual sort of return to the church and finding your way and what, as it were, your relationship was to be from that point on.
Much like a lot of what faith. I found when I got back, either.
Yes, and you that's an interesting part of the book, your description of where you feel Anglicanism has sort of lost its way slightly and that sort of thing.
It's been devastated by people trying to please people like Adam.
I don't think that's true. I agree that there has been a devastation of Anglicanism. I'm not sure the time period over which it's happened. You argue that it's been in the last 50 years, I suppose.
Yeah.
But I am a great fan, in principle, of the sort of traditional English... what Eddie Izzard describes as cake or death Christianity. I think that there are many facets of that Anglicanism which are extremely admirable. What I do see, which I think is much more problematic, is a rise in its place of various forms of Christianity which are not very useful to the future development of countries. And the Alpha Course, I think, is a really good example of that.
Well, let's talk about... I mean, it's not Anglicanism per se that you deal with the changes in, but it's society overall, Peter. And you do lay at the door of in the increasing tide of secularism many of the problems of our society. I mean, do you feel that there is in some way been a moral, if you like, loss in society as we've lost our Christian foundations in some sense?
Well, yes, of course, people come to rely on other things, and one of the things they've come to rely on is wealth and growth and what's termed progress instead. And it's been quite easy to do during most of the 20th century, especially during the second half of it since the Second World War. And one of the other things I do, I don't just write a column for the Mail on Sunday, I do quite a lot of foreign reporting, and I did it before as well. I lived for 2.5 years in Moscow, and I also lived in the United States, and I've seen other societies. And particularly lately, I've been spending a lot of time in China. China is a hugely advanced, prosperous country, but it's completely un-Christian. There are Christians in China, but the nature of the society is not. And you can tell the difference very strongly in the absence of certain things. You just can't expect them to be there. And, of course, there are civilizations and moral codes can exist without Christianity. It's one of the curious things about debating with atheists is they always imagine that what you say is there can be no morality without Christianity and no morality without God. There can be, but it's a much more practical, you do this for me, I'll do this for you.
I have to take issue with
that. Doesn't extend very much beyond that.
I'm unaware of any atheists that think that there can't be any morality without Christianity, as you've...
What I'm saying is that's what... I'm not saying that's what atheists say. I'm saying that's what atheists say, Christians say about atheists. And one of the frustrations about arguing with atheists is that they constantly assume things about Christians that Christians don't think. They think Christians think they're good, which is the reverse of the truth. They think Christians think there can be no there can be no morality of any kind without God, which we don't think. They constantly accuse us of saying, oh, you're an atheist, therefore you must be bad, which we don't ever say and is not in any way a consequence of our position. This is partly because of a deep unwillingness to understand among most atheists what the Christian position is, and which I try to explain in the book, that it isn't a matter of my saying, you're an atheist, you're bad. You're an atheist, everything you do is going as a result to be bad. But what I do say is this, that if you have actually no fundamental way of determining whether any action you undertake is good or bad, the categories you use, which allow you to decide, are Christian ones. And further, that if you create a society in which Christianity is abolished and driven out of public life, driven out of the constitution, driven out of government, driven out of the schools, driven out of broadcasting, driven out of literature, then you will create a society which is worse than one where Christianity is present. And it actually seems to me to be visibly so. Anybody who bothers to visit any parts of this country outside the small areas occupied by the Commentocracy knows perfectly well that it's in a state of severe moral decline, and life has got a lot rougher, particularly for the poor, over the past 30 years as a result of an almost total collapse in unselfishness.
Well, see, I'd have to disagree with both of the main points within there. The first thing is that I don't know any atheists or people who describe themselves as atheists who do believe that the majority of Christians or people of faith think that without Christianity there can be no morals. I just don't know.
Well, I know lots because they come to me on my blog and they constantly make this point to me. And I get it all the time. You think this, you think that. I say, no. And they carry on. They keep on saying it over and over again. They don't listen to the reply. So you may not know any, but I know lots, and they do undoubtedly exist.
And the converse.
So you may not be one of them, but that's that doesn't mean there aren't any.
The converse is also true, that many people come to me and say bland statements such as the ones you're just describing. They actually do say, how can you know what is right and what is wrong if you don't have Christianity within your life? Now, the scientific evidence on this is emerging and is fairly unequivocal, that morality is a universal human trait and is regardless of creed or faith or race or wealth or any of these types of social issues that we're talking about. Now, that to my mind, says that the fact that we can be moral with or without God is a universal truth.
No, you can be enlightenedly self-interested. Anybody can be. That's the golden rule, which people often confuse with Christianity, is a straightforward piece of enlightened self-interest.
But the golden
rule,
you do
as you want to be done by, and you treat other people the way you want them to treat you. If they decide not to do that because they're more powerful and bigger and stronger than you, then tough. If there's nothing which can restrain the person who decides not to abide by the golden rule, then that's one of the points about Christianity. The other thing is that Christianity goes a lot further than the golden rule. It says it enjoins you to actually love your neighbour as yourself, which is much, much, much more potent and much...
And even love your enemy.
Much more demanding than the golden rule. Of course, a form of morality exists because no village could exist without some sort of basic morality. The common decency, it used to be called, open to anybody, but it's not the same thing. And civilizations can exist, have existed, will exist without Christianity, but they will not be the same as those civilizations in which Christianity does exist. I lived in the Soviet Union, the last years of it. It was a civilization of sorts, but it wasn't a Christian civilization, and you could see things missing from it, which were important to me, and I think would be important to you if you had been there to experience it.
I mean, you do draw on your experience in the final days, as it were, of the USSR to some degree in the book, and essentially you draw an analogy with the UK to suggest that this atheist experiment that they were conducting went radically wrong, and that we're essentially treading the same path without really realising it.
It is extraordinary how much congruence there is between the language of the Bolsheviks, who started off, as all these revolutionaries do, with wonderful intentions and the idea of building a new society and creating a new man. It's extraordinary the congruence between the rhetoric they use and the attitude they have towards religion and that of the new wave of anti-theists. I'm not saying that the new wave of anti-theists are Bolsheviks. What I'm saying is that they are social revolutionaries. They do intend to change society, and there are consequences of abandoning God, consequences for people as individuals and consequences for the exercise of power, which are very alarming, and that they are raising from the ground again this dead thing, which a lot of people thought was over in 1991, and that they have no idea of the power of the thing that they're raising or of the dangers of it.
Adam, any response to those?
Well, yes, I think that the conflation of atheism and secularism is problematic in discussions like this. And I agree there are many people who are vocal within this, if you want to call it, movement of atheism, which I don't really see as a social movement at all. I see it as a sort of publishing empire more than anything else. But I'm surprised that one would conflate atheism and secularism and make no distinguish between them in terms of how societies operate. the removal of the separation of church and state, which we have in a fairly reasonable way in the UK, is surely something that we want to promote in a multicultural society.
I'm really not. I don't want a multicultural society. I'm a monoculturalist. I think multiculturalism is a disaster and leads to the creation of hostile solitudes, and is leading to that. So we don't share an aim there to begin with. I think that multiculturalism has been catastrophic for many people. You just go to the city of Bradford and see how the two parts of it have turned their backs upon it, and wonder how the future is going to work out there. And tell me that you're in favour of multiculturalism, I'd be amazed. That is a fundamental disagreement. Secondly, separation of church and state. Well, it certainly seems to have happened, though there is still formally an establishment of the Church of England, and bishops still sit in the House of Lords. And I would regret it very much if the Church of England were disestablished or if the bishops were removed, because I think it would be a very powerful signal that we had de-Christianized our government and our constitution. The next thing to go would be the obviously Christian nature of the coronation service, which may, for all I know, never take place again anyway. And we would then be a post-Christian society. The whole argument about separation of church and state is an American argument about the procedures in the state of Virginia and the Episcopal Church, which has absolutely no bearing whatsoever on the conditions of modern Britain or indeed Britain in the past. And it's a phrase which I don't really see applying here.
I will
distinguish as much as you like between atheism in an individual and a secularist campaign. But what I note in the book, and is very strongly expressed, particularly by Richard Dawkins, but also by others, is a profound intolerance directed towards the idea that parents should be entitled to bring their children up as Christians and to expect the schools of this country to support them in that enterprise. And it's some of the language used by some of the anti-theists, which I quote in that book, is actually very frightening indeed, in terms of the way in which they wished they openly justify censorship and the silencing of views with which they disagree.
We'll get your response to that in just a moment, Adam. We've got to go to a quick break at this point. You're listening to a discussion on the book The Rage Against God, recently penned by Peter Hitchens, Mail on Sunday columnist, author, and brother to Christopher Hitchens. And we've been talking about the new atheism that Christopher Hitchens represents in many ways. If you'd like to respond to anything you're hearing on the programme today, you're more than welcome to send me an email. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I look forward to receiving those and reading them out in a future edition of the programme. Don't forget, you can listen back on the podcast and send on to a friend. You can discover that at the webpage premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And we'll be back with my guests, Adam Rutherford and Peter Hitchens, in just a moment's time.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
The Rage Against God is a response to the modern surge of so-called anti-theism and seeks to address whether society can really live independently of God and faith. Peter Hitchens is the author. He joins me on the programme today. And Adam Rutherford is an atheist. He is in conversation today with Peter on this whole area. And we were getting, gentlemen, towards a sort of area of whether society... Well, whether the ills of society can be laid at the door of increasing secularism, whether abandoning Christian heritage and Christian values to some extent has been the cause of that. Is that fair, Adam? Is it fair to lay at the door of atheism and secularism the ills that society faces today?
Well, no, I don't think it is. But again, those two things are separate concepts, and that secularism is primarily concerned with reducing the undue influence of the church over matters of state. Now, I think that's a perfectly reasonable point of view, and it doesn't negate the possibility that faith can exist in our country. And I think it's unreasonable to assume
but
that it
should
be point,
but it kept to a certain sphere. Is obviously what the secularists would have us would say. Now, I'm getting the idea though that Peter's point is. The problem is you've forgotten that our society has been founded on a very intimate relationship with the Christian faith and the church, and that we reject that at our peril. We're kind of opening it up to whatever the latest sort of thing is in that way. And we can see what happens in societies like the USSR, where they did that, where they said, we're going to reject what has been historically proven to keep this society running.
Right. And I... possibly in disagreement with Peter's argument, he can state that for himself. I don't necessarily see that there is a revolution happening. I think that the conversations that are going on currently about atheism and anti-theism, led by people like Christopher Hitchens and Dawkins and many others, are important conversations, but I don't see them as being radical or revolutionary in terms of the general progress or evolution of societies. I don't see that there has been an event or a period of time where things have become radically different from how they were in the past. That's not to say that traditional mores of Anglicanism in the UK have not changed over the last 50 years, but I don't see them as being this being a radical or revolutionary event.
I think this is rather ahistorical, a failure to grasp that almost everything about this country is based upon Christianity. Its entire legal system is based upon biblical ideas. Another example, that the Houses of Parliament are basically an ecclesiastical building. The chimes of Big Ben are musically based upon the air "I know that my Redeemer liveth" from Handel's Messiah. This is a Christian country in its nature and constitution. And when you ask why is that important, then you have to move on to the next point, which I do try to ask. What is the source of authority? What is the source of the authority of the policeman? What is the source of the authority of the government? What is the source of the authority, if he or she has any, of the parent or teacher in the classroom? And by the nature of its source will be the nature of the way in which that authority is actually exercised. The fact that we have a pluralist society, the fact that we have an adversarial government, the fact that we have freedom of speech, the fact that we have freedom of inquiry, all, as far as I'm concerned, are result from the fact that we are a Christian society. You drive that out, I think it'd be quite interesting if the secularists do succeed in driving it out, which I think at the moment, because I'm a realistic pessimist, I think at the moment that they will, that they will be hideously surprised when they leave the space swept and garnished and find that what comes into it is not the enlightened era of Richard Dawkins, but Islam, which is waiting for the religious revival, which will undoubtedly arrive in this country in the next 30 or 40 years, and is very well placed to take advantage of it. And I wonder how all these people who want to drive Christianity out of our society will enjoy one based upon Sharia.
Well, I don't necessarily disagree with that as a historical premise. I think that there are parallels with the American model, which was set up as a secular society and has seen the emergence of a much more fundamental form of Christianity and much less moderate.
The United States
is
so different.
I understand that it's so different.
It bears almost no resemblance. They're as different as a forest is from a city.
I understand
The United States was designed, Britain grew.
I understand that, but the point you're making about where authority comes from, that is where secularism and atheism do have to have a conversation, because you're talking about a country where authority is enforced from a higher power, which atheists believe does not exist. Now, at that point, secularism becomes very much more connected with atheism, because secularists don't necessarily think that God doesn't exist, but atheists definitely do.
It's just that they prescribe the activity of those who do believe in God.
But we're talking about where you get authority from.
Yes, we are. And if it doesn't derive from the Bible and from Christian precepts and from the teachings of our Lord, then what does it derive from? Does it derive from the will of the people, from mob rule, from whatever election result can be conjured up by television debates, or what? What is the origin of it? Who decides who can do what to whom, under what circumstances? And above all, what governs and limits the actions of government? What is it that says you can't do that? You can't torture him. You can't imprison him for 42 days without trial. What is the force on which that is based? And don't tell me it's human rights, because anybody who examines the European Convention on Human Rights will find that it's profoundly contradictory and is, like all secular moral codes, open to interpretation to suit the people who are actually interpreting it, i.e. the powerful.
Well, that's a very valid point. And in referring to the Human Rights Act as something which is contradictory raises exactly my problem with referring to the authority of the church, not of faith, in being something that governs a country.
I didn't actually say the church, though, did I?
No, but that's what you're talking about.
No, I'm talking about Christianity as a faith and as a moral system resting upon.
Well, in that case, you have to define what your brand of Christianity is. Because,
well,
of course, Christianity is an incredibly wide-ranging set of beliefs, many of which are inherently self-contradictory, many of which say many different things about issues that relate to society. And you're talking about an authority as if there is one true voice. And I think your one true voice is very different from many other Christians that exist in this country.
Well, I don't know. I would have thought that the authorised version of the Bible as interpreted in the 1662 Book of Common Prayer is fairly straightforward. And I don't know what these contradictions are to which you refer, but perhaps you give me an example of one.
Well, so, for example, you could take almost any example are live issues within the General Synod. Is it okay to be a homosexual?
Within the General Synod? I'm not suggesting the General Synod should be the government of the country. I loathe the General Synod, just as the General Synod loathes the authorized
version. What's the authority?
1662 prayer book.
What's the authority you're referring to?
The authority, as I say, is the tradition, the Anglican tradition of scripture, tradition, and reason. That's another thing which secularists and atheists tend to smugly assume has no part in religion. They say there's no reason in it. And those processes which led to the Anglican settlement in this country and which created, by and large, the constitution we have now. The question of homosexuality is so marginal. Look, the question of sexual morality is this. Is it right or is it wrong for people to have sexual relations outside marriage? As far as Christianity is concerned, not. The real issue of this, and the one about which we should be exercised, is not the issue of homosexuality, which is, as I say, extraordinarily marginal and affects hardly anybody. The issue is over whether marriage should actually be dissoluble by the state, as it has been since the 1968 Divorce Law Reform Act in the most extraordinarily profligate way. And that's the real moral problem which confronts this country. And if you want a fundamental contradiction between what Christianity states and what the government does, then look at that. The state now has the power. So two people contract a marriage, and they make an enormous lifelong promise. If one of those people now decides to break that promise, the state has the power to drag the other person out of the house by force and under threat of prison, rather than allow them to continue the marriage. And that reversal of the power of Christianity and its replacement by the power of the state in our society has had immense consequences. You may like it. You may think that easy divorce is great. You may think that the fact that millions of children don't have stable families behind them is a terrific advance. I don't happen to think so. That's one of the really powerful moral questions which has been raised by the de-Christianization.
You also, at various points, mention abortion, which I'm guessing is, for you, another example of one of these issues. Of what you saw in the Soviets system as well.
It was the main method of contraception. I think at the point that I was living there, the number of abortions outnumbered the number of live births, and it seems to me to be plainly wrong to kill a living creature. But it's one of those things where people say, you don't need the Ten Commandments to tell you how to behave. Well, I have to tell you that if the Ten Commandments are removed from this, then people will immediately say, oh no, abortion is not murder, it's just a blob of jelly. This thing doesn't matter, it's not a life, it doesn't count. Because people will always, just as they will do the same with the atrocious massacre of German civilians by Bomber Command during the 1940s, they'll always say, oh, that was all right, that was morally justified. People will always morally justify murder when they think it suits them, and they will keep on doing it unless you have an absolute code which prevents it.
Okay, so when we do away with this absolute code, which secularism would do away with, we increasingly open the door to the ill effects Peter's suggesting of that we see in society.
So you're suggesting that if we have no God in society, then abortions will become the main method of contraception?
Well, they virtually have done. It goes right. Ever since the Abortion Act, the abortion law reform of 1967 was predicated on the idea that that there would be very few abortions, that it would prevent the illegal abortions taking place in back streets, which everyone was worried about, and that it was a last resort, which would only be undertaken when two doctors had consented to it. Year by year, the numbers of abortions go up and up and up, and the numbers of abortions which actually are performed on people who've had abortions before, not just once or twice, but three or four times, goes up and up, because it's a backstop. If people can't be bothered to use contraception and they find themselves pregnant, they have an abortion. And the more of it there is, the more of it there is. It's statistically demonstrable. Even with immense amounts of propaganda about condoms distributed to people at incredibly young ages and the morning after pill and all the rest of it, abortion carries on going up. It seems to me to be completely demonstrable that the legalization of abortion has led to more of it, and will continue to lead to more.
So let me just get this straight. So in your, I'm not quite sure what you're proposing as a model for how things should be, but one of the things that you are suggesting is that all forms of abortion is illegal. Is that right?
Well, as a matter of fact, I mean, I personally feel that, and would say that abortion under all circumstances is wrong. But as a matter of fact, the law before 1967 was based upon a court case in which a doctor had aborted a child who'd been raped by three soldiers just round the corner from Whitehall in, I think, 1938. And he was cleared by the court on the basis that his action had been justifiable. And on that basis, it was possible for people to have abortions under extreme circumstances, which I think was probably a sensible compromise. Those doctors who wanted to perform abortions hated the law because it put the burden of proof on them that they had actually acted in a genuine emergency. So there are two issues here. One, the personal moral one. One, the issue of just how far society can legislate. As far as I can say, it's wrong. There's no circumstance under which an adoption wouldn't be better than an abortion. But if people really, really feel that an abortion is essential, I suppose you could leave room for it. But the existing law, which effectively licenses abortion on demand, is a criminal act, as far as I can say.
There's no circumstances. Could you just repeat that? There's no circumstances where abortion is acceptable.
There's no circumstances in which I can see where abortion is preferable to adoption.
So, for example, in the case where the mother's life was at risk or the child was going to be born with severe abnormalities, in those situations, acceptable or not?
Well, I think mother's life being at risk is a difficult problem. I don't know whether you can give me any instances of it where an abortion would be the only way of dealing with the problem.
But I can't give any specific.
No, I'm not sure it's raised all the time, and I'm not quite sure what these positions are. I mean, cesarean section is extremely easy these days. I don't know of any circumstance, and the response to a baby being imperfect doesn't seem to me to be to kill it. We're not entitled to do so, and that you wouldn't do it if an imperfect child existed outside the womb. We all know which regime it was that used to massacre imperfect people after they'd been born. I don't myself see a fundamental difference between killing someone because they're imperfect in the womb and killing someone because they're imperfect outside the womb. Maybe you do. I don't know what it is.
Let me ask you this question. I'm assuming that you believe that a person that's at the point of conception, when a sperm fertilizes an egg, that becomes a person.
That seems to me to be the only sustainable view. You can't find, I don't think science has been able to find, any other point at which you can define the beginning of life.
No, there isn't a consensus on the beginning of a human.
It's not possible. It seems to me to be the point at which it's...
So what characteristics of a single-cell fertilized egg are human?
Well, all of them, as far as I can see.
What, they are capable of communication, they're capable of social interactions, they're capable of forming independent views.
No, that's not the characteristics of the human. This will grow into a human being unless it is prevented from doing so by violence.
So what about, are you also opposed to things like in vitro fertilization?
I'm confused about it, to be honest, and don't claim any expertise on it. I think, I mean, I have Roman Catholic friends who constantly try and persuade me to take stern positions on it. I don't, because I don't know enough about it, but it does seem to me to be self-evident that killing unborn babies is wrong. And every opportunity I have to say it, I'll say it, because it just seems to me to be so blindingly obvious and such an immense wickedness in our society that if I didn't say it, even if it disadvantaged me to say it, then I would be failing in my duty.
I mean, you've asked for clarification on Peter's position. I'd be interested in hearing your position here, Adam, because am I to take it from what you've been saying that you believe what science shows us about the cell, indeed I think you presented a whole programme on television about the cell, shows that we can have good reason for believing that life doesn't begin at this stage, that it is in effect then the progress we've made in the last 50 years that gives us good reason for believing that there isn't any damage being done when we abort a child. I don't know, the term currently in the UK is what the cut-off term is
24 weeks legally.
Do you believe there's a sort of that's justified scientifically, that we can come to these conclusions not because of a morality in a book, but because we've scientifically looked into this and decided this is the moral sort of framework?
There's two different questions at stake here. The first is, at what point does a fertilised egg become a person? And there is no scientific consensus on this. There is no scientific definition of what that could possibly be.
You're slipping, from human to a person. You're trying to define the human not as a physically, objectively existing thing, but as a social being, which, of course, no one in a womb can be. So presumably you're not a person until the moment you're born, by that definition, but you're still a human.
Well,
this kind of sophistry is what you get when people want to justify killing for their own convenience. An abortion is conducted almost invariably for the convenience of ourselves.
Let's allow Adam to finish there. Yeah.
But as I said, there isn't a scientific consensus on it. The reason we have 24 weeks as the cut-off point, unless there are medical reasons to extend beyond that, is because there's no scientific evidence that younger fetuses than 24 weeks have an increased survival rate.
Listen to the word fetus. It's a fetus. It's a nice Latin word. It's dehumanized already. It's not a baby. It's a fetus.
That's correct.
It's dehumanized so you can kill it.
It's not a baby.
That's what killers always do. They dehumanize their victim before they kill it.
A fetus is not a baby, and there's no possible way that you could argue that is a baby.
Right.
Well, try
it. It's extraordinary, isn't it? That the one thing you can show anything. You can show anything on British television. Any kind of disemboweling. Almost any kind of sexual activity. You can play any word. They were using four-letter words on the 10 o'clock news on the BBC last night, but the one thing you cannot show on television is film of an abortion and what it involves, because it shows quite plainly that what is being destroyed is a human person.
Well, that's also not true, though that has been shown on TV, and I've worked with fetuses that have been aborted. I can't quote the specific documentaries, but they do exist. I have seen it on TV. Also, I have worked with aborted fetuses.
TV, never.
No, that is incorrect. I don't have that reference.
Well, if you're going to maintain it's incorrect, you're going to have to tell me when it was.
Well, I can't do it now, but maybe I'll email
it. Don't say it's incorrect.
I have worked with aborted fetuses. I have during the course of my scientific studies, and I don't believe that the things that I have dealt with in the lab situation, which have come from abortions, are human beings. They look like them, they resemble them in physically, but they are not human beings.
Good Lord. I mean, this is concentration camp
language. The question is, though, I suppose,
if they look like human beings, but hey, no, they're not. They're Jews.
Well, I mean,
I'm puzzled by that.
It's amazing. They're not human beings. It's the oldest thing in the book, isn't it? Before you kill, you dehumanize. You say they're not really. No. I'm not. This isn't any kind of killing of a human being. It's something else. We declassify it. We give it another name. Give me strength. Okay, you want to believe that? You believe it, but it's the most perfect illustration of the position in which the person who acknowledges no absolute law gets himself into. He can argue himself within 10 minutes into the most appalling positions without even realizing that they're appalling.
I mean, I suppose that the point that is being made here, Adam, is what gives you the moral authority to decide when a human life begins?
He's a scientist, that's what.
Is it that? Science doesn't inform my morality at all. The second question in this is, so there's a scientific point at which we fail to agree on, and science doesn't have a decent answer for, which is, at what point does a fetus become a human? We've talked about that. The second point is why I feel morally justified in supporting abortion in principle, which is to do, I believe, with the mother's right to choose her own destiny, and to the extent that it is an adult human is more important than an unborn, unsentient fetus. And I believe that is a moral absolute. And I don't see how you could argue against that.
You don't see how you could argue against it? I can see how you can arrive at your conclusion. I used to believe it, this piffle, but I perfectly well see how you arrive at it. You can't see how anyone can imagine that the what you call a fetus might be human and that it might be wrong to kill it.
Well,
you really
can't see that the woman's
right to choose doesn't somehow interfere with the unborn child's right to live.
The unborn
if you're dealing with these rights, or doesn't have one, or is that right so small? And what is this right to choose? On what grounds is it exercised exactly? What do you have to prove these days to establish that you can choose to kill this person who, in your view, isn't a human, and in my view, is, but might be?
I'm not arguing that abortion should be available freely available to everyone as a means of contraception that you've asserted occurred
in Russia.
So what
limits would you put upon it? I
believe that education about sex education is important in preventing the negative aspects of sex.
Ever since we had sex education, we've had more abortion, we've had more out of wedlock and early pregnancy, we've had more sexually transmitted disease. I can't actually establish, because the work hasn't been done, that sex education leads to these things, but if its stated purpose is to reduce them, then it has failed abjectly ever since it began. It's a mathematical connection. In this country, sex education has been accompanied by an increase in all the things it claims to prevent and contain.
Well, you assert that, and correlation and causation are not the same. But let me ask you this then. In place of sex education, which attempts to reduce the negative aspects of sex, such as unwanted pregnancies and STDs, what would you have in its place?
I wouldn't have anything in its place. I don't think it's the business of schools to teach people how to put condoms on hockey sticks and bananas. I think the schools are not there for this purpose. I think sex education, I think, is what George Lukács thought when he introduced it during the Hungarian Bolshevik uprising, was always an attempt to debauch and demoralize Christian societies. That's what its purpose is.
But children are going to have sex. Teenagers are going to have sex. Yes.
Are they?
Yes.
Are you sure? Are they going to have sex under all circumstances?
16-year-olds shouldn't have sex.
I'm saying that people shouldn't have sex outside marriage. That's my belief.
And so how do you engender that? So I don't believe there are any.
By having a strong moral system, which makes it plain that this is how people should behave.
And you think that will prevent teenagers from having sex with each other?
You know, to a large extent, yes, it will. No human system is infallible. Humans are, as we know, or as I know, fallen creatures. So yes, there will be people who defy that morality. But you don't actually need to make much effort to study our own society's past to see just how much horror and dislike were actually directed against adultery and against premarital and extramarital sex, and how our society was different. You may say that it was worse than it was, and I may say that it was better, but there's absolutely no question that a strong morality generally accepted changes the behaviour of society and makes it different. And one of the things it makes different is the attitude towards children, who in our society are disposable in the womb and neglected and tossed aside in life, with catastrophic consequences.
We are going to have to take another break, I'm afraid, at this point, and we'll be actually starting to wind up our conversation. You're listening to a heated discussion today between Adam Rutherford and Peter Hitchens, my guests on the programme, as we look at Peter's book, The Rage Against God, written in response in many ways to a surge of anti-theism in recent years, led by his brother, Christopher. And that's a fascinating aspect of the book, if you're able to pick it up, published by Continuum, and you'll be able to sort of see the journey that Peter describes in his own life, and how that has interacted with his own brother's story. So we're back in a couple of moments' time. Once again, if you want to interact with the issues today, you're welcome to send me an email. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And do check out the webpage as well. And I'll be putting links up to both my guests, to Peter's column, to Adam's website, and to how you can find out more about the issues we've been looking at today. premier.org.uk/unbelievable. We'll be back to conclude our discussion in a moment's time. Welcome back to Unbelievable, the show that hopefully gets you thinking. And, well, usually we have a Christian, non-Christian format. If you're listening next week, we're going to be actually having an inter-Christian discussion, as we often do. In fact, the next 2 weeks will be in that format, as we look at probably one of the biggest dividing issues in the Christian church today. It is, of course, homosexuality. And we're going to be asking the fundamental question in our first programme next week of, does the Bible condone homosexuality? My guest for that programme in the studio are going to be Mike Dark of the organisation Accepting Evangelicals, an evangelical Christian who believes that his homosexual relationship is compatible with his Christian faith. We'll also be hearing from John Richardson of the theologically conservative group Reform in the Anglican Church. He's a vicar, and he'll be explaining why he doesn't believe that homosexuality is compatible with the Bible, certainly not practising homosexuality. So that's the first of two programmes. The second one to follow on from that we'll be looking at whether the church itself is homophobic. So I do hope you'll be able to join me for those two very important programmes at the same time next week between 2:30 and 4. And I look forward to you joining me online as well at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Right now, it's time to get back to talking about Peter Hitchin's new book, The Rage Against God.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
We've really sort of been looking at that moral area of abortion, and one, funnily enough, I noticed that you're a bit of a fan of Evan Harris, Adam, and I had him on the programme not long ago talking about abortion and very similar issues coming to the fore at that time as well. But to get back to the central theme of this book, one thing that appears to come across to me is, Peter, this sense that you believe there is, a rebellion against God, that it's not just that atheists and Christopher Hitchens and others don't believe in God, it's that they are actually against what God might do to them in terms of putting boundaries on their behaviour.
Well, this is a mystery, and I think I have to exempt Adam from this because he appears to have been brought up without belief and therefore not to have needed to fight it off at any stage. But the generation that my brother writes from, and I think Richard Dawkins writes from, and Philip Pullman writes from, is a generation which was brought up when Christianity was still the accepted, as it were, default position of the intelligent, educated person in this country, from which if you had to dissent, you had to dissent from knowledge and from experience, whereas the success of the secularists over the past 40 years is such that many people are now growing up without any experience of Christianity whatsoever. But among those who are the anti-theists, the ones who need to virulently to reject God, there seems to me to be a mystery. What is it? Why are they so angry? And I quote the American philosopher Thomas Nagel in the book as being one of those atheists who I have a lot of time for because he's interested in this question. He asks, why is it that we want there not to be a God? He doesn't really answer it, but at least he recognises that it's a reasonable question to ask. As I don't think Adam's really involved in this because he comes from a society already stripped by and large of Christianity, where he didn't need to reject it. He was born and brought up without it, so he doesn't feel this.
The way I felt it when I
burnt my Bible, and which is the incident which opens the book, and the way in which I no longer feel it, an attitude which I now regard as fundamentally immature and adolescent.
Well, that's something that we can agree on. I was raised, as most people were, I was born in 75, still in a largely Christian society. I went to a Christian school and sang in a church choir until I was 18. I've spent large periods of my life in church. I admire many of the aspects of religion that we have historically had in this country. I also think it's very important that children are educated about Christianity, certainly from a historical perspective, because there is no doubt, as we've talked about a bit, that this country has historically been based on Christian values. I don't deny that at all. I think that there probably is a lack of understanding of basic Christian principles within schools now. And we mentioned the Alpha Course earlier. This was something that came up in my discussions off the course with the curate of the church that I did it in. They talk, Alpha talk about how the people going to Alpha now are the de-churched.
Unchurched.
Unchurched. Mm. So people who are raised
within
Christian...
They have no experience of church in their background.
No, Toby Hall, the curate, was suggesting that the people going to Alpha at this point in time were unchurched, i.e. they'd been raised in a Christian setting but had not been to church for many years, and
right.
So were willing to go back to church and to find out what it was that they were... They're missing out on. The fear that he expressed to me is that in the next 10, 15 years, they will be replaced by the de-churched who have no concept of who Jesus was in any way. Christianity is undoubtedly important in this country. It forms many of the central cultural aspects that I consider to be very valuable to Englishness and Britishness, which I also value a lot. I do think it is a problem that children these days are generally... ignorant of Christian values.
What about this idea, though, that I don't just not believe in God, I don't want there to be a God? That's the sense that Peter drew out from that from Thomas Nagel, that there is a sense among atheists that even if it could be shown that there was a God, that would be incredibly annoying to the average atheist, because it would mean that presumably their life was protracted in some way, that there was an authority to which they were answerable. Is there any sense in which this anti-God sentiment is based upon this idea that I don't want there to be an authority over me in my life? I'd much rather be an independent person. Is that what the atheist thing is all about, ultimately? Independence. I can do what I want and make my own decisions. Thank you very much.
I think there may be some truth in that. I certainly don't feel the anger towards something that I don't believe in. It doesn't bother me that God exists, which is why I say that secularism is a much more important question. It bothers me that the influence of the church can affect the way I live my life. That is problematic. So I don't really understand why people are so angry about the idea of faith.
Okay. Peter, do you want to... We're going to have to draw things to a close. Perhaps you'd like to respond there and...
Well, no. I think why should you be? But I think that the attempt to, which is basically what secularism is about, the attempt to de-Christianize the institutions and laws and rules of society, is a militant act and a destructive act. And those who conduct it seem to me to need to explain rather more thoroughly what it is they want to get rid of and why they want to get rid of it and what it is they have against this being a Christian country. And they don't do that. But what ultimately it is about, it's two things. First of all, a lot of people don't actually understand it because it's gone so deep into the universities and the media since the 60s that it's become everybody's default position. This is kind of vague radicalism. They don't understand the origins of it, the Gramscian origins of it, the revolutionary philosophical origins of a lot of what people are taught and take as normal. But it's combined extraordinarily with the most hedonistic generation for centuries as well, one which really wants to indulge itself enormously, particularly sexually, and which sees the existence of Christian laws and governance and assumptions in society as a challenge to its own desires and a restraint. And here we have a major argument between two different kinds of societies, which is presented as a kind of liberation struggle against an evil remnant. What I want to see is a clear and straightforward argument about what it is these people actually want, why they want to overthrow it. And I would also like to hear from the Christian churches a little bit more of a coherent defense of why this ought to be a Christian society and the advantages which undoubtedly flow from that.
It's been fascinating, and I'm sorry we don't have more time to continue the discussion. But, Peter, thank you very much for coming in. The book, The Rage Against God, as I say, published by Continuum, available in all good bookstores and online, of course. I'll put some links up to where you can get yourself a copy with the podcast of this programme. Find that at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Also, thanks to you, Adam. Great of you to come in. Thank you for engaging. It got a bit heated in here occasionally, and you both dealt very well. Well, thanks for being with me. And if you're listening and you want to find out what you've been saying about previous weeks of programming, including that interview with Philip Pullman last week, then we'll be finding your feedback to that in just a moment's time.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
And I'll give you out the podcast details again near towards the end of the programme. 08456 52 52 52 is the number to ring to respond to anything you heard on the programme today. Select option 8 if you want to leave me a voicemail message there. Or as many people have been doing in the last week, you can email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I do try to respond to every new emailer that gets in touch with me personally, but I also try to read as many as possible. If you don't hear yours today, you may hear it in a future programme. Just a quick shout out to Jesse Montes in Canada, who says that you really love the show, that you're working your way through the podcast daily as you commute to work via bicycle. You say, "I'm constantly promoting your show to my friends who love to engage in the topics you tackle. Thanks for being so bold and engaging atheists and other religions in a respectable manner. It's a breath of fresh air. I'm writing this email to take advantage of your book offer that you gave on the 14th of February 2009. Yes, at the time, Jesse, we were giving away books, but I'm afraid that was over a year ago, and I'm afraid that offer no longer stands, but you were very gracious in understanding that when I emailed you back. Now, lots of response to the show with Philip Pullman of last week, and it's still coming in, but let's just give you an overview of many of the things that were said. Sarah Goddard emails in to say, "Tuned in today for the first time and really enjoyed your discussion with Pullman. I agree with your commentator," that was Martin Saunders in the studio with me last week, "who said that we should engage in discussions about our faith. It's helpful to listen to people's views and opinions in an open way without being judgmental and reactionary. Sometimes we as Christians can be so defensive that we close debate and appear to have a chip on our shoulder. Sometimes the questions raised can be challenging, but again, it's important to constantly look at why we believe what we believe. I thought that Mr. Pullman's reading from a passage in his book regarding the church was wonderful and spoke to me of the desire of many people to see the church respond to people in our society out of love and by meeting their needs, a requirement of not only Christians, but obviously atheists as well. So often we seem to hide behind buildings that seem closed to many, and in fact often are. Rather than being the first place to call when life becomes a struggle and things go wrong, the church appears to many irrelevant, judgmental and hypocritical. Do we need to take the radical move of leaving these buildings and selling the land to fund projects that provide shelter, care and healing to vulnerable people? Church can take place in homes, villages, halls and out in the open. Wouldn't this be the sort of action, show the real heart of Jesus?" Well, I think, as you said, Philip Pullman would agree wholeheartedly with you. In fact, he was remarkably open about, as he said at the end of last week's show, being very, very pro-Jesus, is how he described himself. Just not for institutionalised, organised religion, I suppose. But inevitably, you know, you have to kind of have some kind of organisation. Buildings aren't inevitably a necessary part of things. They just shouldn't become the central focus. Alex Avril says, "Interesting broadcast today, as always. Thanks for such a stimulating programme. Philip Pullman is a clever, interesting writer, but he's an atheist, and atheists have an agenda. They simply don't want the good news to be true. It cannot be true. They cannot even consider it to be true. It must be ruled out, because what if it turns out to be true? They've made not just a big mistake, but it's too late. I think C.S. Lewis got it right. He said Jesus was either a liar, a lunatic, or he was who he said he was. He came to that conclusion after years of discussion and study that he was not a liar or a lunatic, and therefore he was who he said he was, and he needed to do something about it." Thank you very much, Avril. Janelle Julian is aged 15, probably one of the youngest emailers I've had in my experience, Janelle, so thank you for listening. You wanted to say, "I'd like to say something about that discussion on the good man Jesus and the scoundrel Christ." That was, of course, the title of the book by Philip Pullman that we were discussing with him last week, along with Bible scholar Anthony McCroy and Christian journalist Martin Saunders. And you say, "Janelle, I believe that the Bible is the Word of God and that everything in it was meant to be there. A lot of people have have prayed over what should go into the Bible, and I believe God wrote his word through those people. They weren't twisting the story or making stuff up because God was in control of it all. As Christians, we believe in the supernatural. We believe in the healing of the Holy Spirit. This means that Jesus did heal the blind and lame, because if he didn't, and if we just think maybe he was an ordinary man, then aren't we throwing away our entire faith? We're throwing away what it means to be a Christian, and that is to be a follower of Christ. I'd in a sense, agree wholeheartedly with you, Janelle, and that's, in a sense, you know, the nub of where Philip Pullman and a Christian disagree. Philip Pullman is all for Jesus and the good things he said. He just doesn't believe any of the claims about his deity and the supernatural things he did are actually true. And for me, Christianity becomes then just a shell of moral teachings. It sort of, it becomes no more than that. And obviously, as Christians, we believe Christianity, our faith, Jesus, is far more than just a moral teacher. He is the very person through whom we have the power to lead that moral life, who gives us that ability in that sense. Ken in Azusa, California, says the problem with Philip Pullman was the program with Philip Pullman was very interesting. Although I have not read his book, I have two comments. The view that Jesus's miracles can be explained through natural phenomena, while it was very popular in the 19th and into the 20th century, has actually been largely abandoned by biblical scholars who reject that these events were mighty deeds of God. I also find it disconcerting that seemingly week after week, the atheists on the program continue to make claims about what is good or bad, what should be done or not done, without ever facing up to the real problem that if there is no God, then there's no basis for morality beyond what individuals like or dislike. And the likes and dislikes are pretty useless for making decisions about what an entire society ought to do. The email address, if you want to get in touch yourself with your response to that programme with Philip Pullman, of course, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. If you want to listen back to it again or haven't had a chance to listen yet, do urge you to go to premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Listen to the programme. Alongside that, I've posted in the features section of the Unbelievable webpage another debate between Philip Pullman and the former Bishop of Oxford, the Right Reverend Richard Harris, on the book, courtesy of the English Pen. Thanks to them for providing us with audio of that as well. It wasn't working just at the start of last week. We've fixed that. So if you downloaded the show very quickly after the Saturday and weren't able to get the link to the programme, that extra piece of audio, it's there now. You can access that just by clicking on the features tab at the Unbelievable webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Another new listener, Matthew Codd, got in touch with me to say, I stumbled across Unbelievable last Saturday afternoon, and I want to tell you how good it feels to know that there are other people out there thinking about the same sorts of things and asking the same sorts of questions that have been rattling around in my head for years. I've just begun to explore the resources, the podcasts, etc., available through your website, and I'm still feeling like a kid in a sweet shop. Congratulations on what you've achieved so far. To show that I come in peace, well, even if you weren't a Christian, I would believe you came in peace, Matthew, but you say, here's a jolly little poem I wrote, which seems to chime with your Christianity meets atheism theme. So a bit of a poet, Matthew. Here's what he writes. The atheist scientist gave me a grin as he settled back into his chair. I asked how this multiverse came to begin. He said, oh, it's just always been there. Well, of course, there's no evidence, he carried on. Good Lord, how could there possibly be? But the point is, without a beginning or ending, there's no room for your deity. Okay, science may be about finding a reason for stuff that you don't understand, but original cause is where my curiosity reaches a premature end. Believer and atheist fell into silence, two faiths and poles apart, expression of love versus ultimate meaningless, an affair of the heart. I rather like that. Thank you very much, Matthew. And if you've got any more, send them through. Now, in weeks previous to last week's programme, we had people like Stephen Law, atheist, on the programme with Dennis Alexander of the Faraday Institute, talking about the Test of Faith initiative, but particularly in regards to now that we have science, do we need God, sort of thing. Now, a few people wanted to respond to that as well. Here's Errol, who says, I've just discovered your podcast and thoroughly enjoyed your most recent discussion with Stephen Law and Dennis Alexander. Whilst I understand your audience isn't limited to Christians, it's unique in showcasing debate about the reasonableness of faith to theists. I am convinced that a reasoned analysis of the tenets of any religious faith will result in a rejection of that dogma. the fact that hundreds of millions of people apparently accept the tenets of Christianity continues to fascinate me. While I doubt that your show will convert me to Christianity, any more than the arguments of your atheist guests will convert the Christian faithful, you are offering an invaluable window into the thinking of those that hold radically opposing views. Keep up the good work, and I'd be delighted if you could bring back Professor Law for a return engagement. I'm sure we'll do our best to bring Stephen back on the show for you, Errol. This is Errol, by the way, in Ontario, Canada. And thank you for listening. And in a way, the show has done its job if it's simply shown you in some way that Christians believe, at least they have reasonable, you know, reasons for believing what they believe. Of course, I don't expect within the course of a show or even listening to our entire archive that an atheist will necessarily be converted. Far from it. But I do believe that at least it may show that there is a reasonableness to this, that there's an argument to be had. It's not just that Christians believe in fairy tales and just have a blind faith. There's some reason behind this. You may not reach the same conclusion, but in my personal experience, for me, the faith and the reason go together in a way that is, well, very satisfactory. Let's look at also some of your responses. By the way, if you want to respond to that show, there's a lot of discussion about it going on at the Premier community, and I encourage you to drop by there and see the discussions going on. The Unbelievable page of that, the Unbelievable group, is where you can find a lot of those discussions going on. So, again, easy to reach that via the webpage at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Click on the link to the Premier community and it'll take you there. And a lot of people still discussing those that Guerrilla Christian programme of a few weeks ago now, when David Robertson came on and was grilled by four atheists, all with different questions. Keith got in touch just on that issue about whether the Old Testament laws about stoning people for things that we would consider to be completely irrelevant even today. What Keith wanted to point out was that in listening to that podcast, the phrase "shall be put to death" can be translated in the passive tense, i.e. shall surely die prematurely. And that's all you've written, Keith, but obviously what you're getting at there is the idea that it's not necessarily an injunction to kill always that we find in those Old Testament prescriptions, but that it may be that it's rather a warning that those who do those things will suffer the consequences in a premature death because of the type of action they've taken. Interesting thought. Now, someone who had quite a long email to me in response to that programme is David. And David actually wrote this for David Robertson, our Christian guest on that programme as well. I'm not going to read out the whole email, but I'll give you the gist of it. You say, "I've heard David Robertson several times on the radio show, and I found his comments enlightening." And speaking of David, you say, "In particular, I tuned into a recent show in which you were questioned by four atheists. I found the discussion frustrating because the atheists failed to ask the questions that I myself wrestle with. A bit of background, I was born and raised a Christian and had very positive experiences in church as a child. But in my teens, I gravitated to agnosticism for intellectual reasons and remain an agnostic today, some 40 years later. Yet I find myself compelled to rethink my position on Christianity and would readily embrace it if I could satisfy my qualms about four questions related to belief in God generally and Jesus in particular. And given your expertise in Christian apologetics," and I reiterate again, you're speaking to David here, David Robertson, "I thought I'd send you these four questions in hopes that you might take a bit of time out of your very busy day to tackle them. I also very much appreciate the programme Unbelievable. It's thought-provoking." So your questions, and to boil them down just to literally their titles, would be on the question of absolute morality, "I agree, yet the abhorrent practices of slavery," and the Bible at the same time seems to approve of that. We have to ask ourselves, can the Bible itself, which seems to vary on its morality, be a source of absolute morality? Was one of the things you wanted to ask. Question two, claims that God sometimes intervenes to miraculously heal people of illnesses. You ask that question about, well, have we ever seen a miracle that was unambiguous in terms of it, an amputated limb grows back spontaneously? That sort of thing. Am I failing to understand why the absence of these examples of restored limbs don't make the other types of healings a superstition. Question three, you want to know why in Matthew 24, Jesus appears to say that this generation will not pass away before he returns 2,000 years later. How can that possibly be true? Well, we have done a programme on that, and I did direct you towards that, David. And question four, the Bible takes a dim view of homosexuality, defining it as a sin and insisting that only sex within marriage involving a man and a woman receives God's approval. But you say, for me, as far as you can see, it's a genetic thing. So why would God create some people to have that genetic disposition? So four questions, and obviously I've sent those on to David. I hope you know that he will get time to respond to that. You've also shared these questions openly, David, so I know you don't mind me reading these out, on our Premier community at the Unbelievable group there. So if you've got any answers to any of those questions for David, I encourage you to go online and interact with that discussion he's posted there after sending me this email, premier.org.uk/unbelievable, and click on the link to the Premier community. I did email David back, and he said he's happy for me to share a little of our correspondence, and I thanked him for the email, and this is what I wrote back to David. I would say briefly, there are satisfactory answers to all your questions. Ultimately, though, I am not a Christian because all my questions on the various puzzling areas of faith have been answered. Many have been, but some things are still difficult for me to comprehend. Instead, I am a Christian because I've placed my faith in Jesus Christ, who I believe is the Son of God, who died and rose again. Now, would having all your questions answered really mean you could embrace faith again? There's always going to be more questions. For me, the central thing is Jesus. If we have grasped who he is and believed in him, not just in some kind of propositional statement, then we can know that Christianity is actually true, even if we don't always know the answers to all the peripheral questions that inevitably arise. So, David kindly wrote back again and said that, in fact, yes, he really would embrace Christianity if he could find an answer to those four questions. If he felt those questions could be satisfactorily answered, he would become a Christian again. Anyway, thank you for all your suggestions as well in that email for other shows that we might consider sort of looking at issues on. And you mentioned homosexuality is one of the issues, of course, in your email that you'd like an answer to. Well, I hope that in some way the next couple of weeks may be helpful, David. We're going to be tackling that very subject. So I think it's about time I told you what's coming up on the show at the same time next week.
You're unbelievable.
We're going to be hearing from Accepting Evangelicals. Mike Dark is a member of that organisation. He's a gay Christian and he's in a homosexual relationship. We'll be finding out from him why he believes that is compatible with the Bible and with his Christian faith. We'll be hearing on the other side of the debate John Richardson, who's a member of the theologically conservative group Reform in the Anglican Church. He's a vicar. He's going to be explaining why he doesn't believe the Bible condones homosexuality. And we'll also be having special phone guests in the course of the next 2 weeks as we continue in a second programme to look at whether the church is homophobic. So I do hope you can stay with us for next week's programme. You'll tune back in again or pick up the podcast. Thanks for listening this week, and God bless you for the week ahead.